Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Happy Saturday, folks. It's Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. Oh, boy. You know, I say this every week, but what a week. I'm going to focus on just a few things this week. There's a zillion headlines I could rat-a-tat-tat through. I think I'm going to save that for next week. And I got some great stuff planned for next week, too. But this week, we're going to focus, and of course we're going to have our story. I mean, what's a week with Reed on the Right Side Radio without our historical story? So we're going to have our story. Then we're going to talk about the Barr hearings in the Senate, which I watched. And I'm going to connect some dots for you that nobody seems to be connecting. I mean, you hear some of them here and some of them there and, you know, whatever. But nobody's kind of giving you the picture of the dots from the stratosphere. Then we're going to talk very briefly, because that's like all she's worth, about Omar's latest, stampede of anti-American words. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And that's going to be the perfect lead into our buddy, Barack Hussein Obama, our dear friend, American-loving, capitalist-natured Barry Obama. And this show, I've been over some of this stuff with all you folks over the last 4 or 5 years. I was one of the first in the media, in fact, to bring some of Barry's sordid and questionable background into focus. But this is probably the best compendium that you have heard anywhere about who Barack Obama is. And why do you say, are we spending time on Barack Obama? He's not president anymore. Because Barack Obama is a spider in the center of the progressive web. And that web, and as you'll see, it's all related. And that web is financed and spun by George Soros and others. And I've done shows on Soros too. Why do I do these shows? Because Barry Obama, Michelle Mybelle, and Valerie Jarrett, particularly, still wield immense, maybe absolute, power in the progressive, that it would be the communist, Islamist wing of the Democratic Party. And I think we can all agree that it is that wing of the party which is more or less running the show for the DNC, for Congress, etc. What I'm going to share with you this morning, you're going to sit back and go, wow. Because it is a collection of contacts, dots, bullet points, irrefutable actions. I mean, this is not nonsense. This is facts I'm giving you. This is not surmise. And when you hear it all at one time, rather than spread out over several shows or from this media source or that media source over years, you will understand, number one, what is the impetus behind the alt-left and the unholy alliance between the alt-left and Islamists. And you will understand just how dangerous these people are to you, your family, your security, your pocketbook, your assets, your freedoms, and your country. And I'm going to start off that segment, in fact, with an article that was written by a well-known black, who, by the way, is not a conservative. He's kind of a liberal black radio commentator and journalist, very well-known, Michael Massey. I think you'll find it quite interesting. I'll just leave it at that. So, listen, without further ado, because this weekend is my mother's 95th birthday celebration. I mean, she's a pistol. She rocks, she rolls, she does real estate, she writes books. I mean, she's unbelievable. She is the definition of most 60-year-olds today. So, I am not going to rush you my my valued listeners, but I'm not going to bump around this morning either. I'm going to get her done. I'm going to kick this donkey through the corral gate. So let's start off with our story. Now, this is one I almost guarantee you have never, ever heard. In fact, probably most of the historical great stories I bring you haven't heard. But this one you'll really love. So, do you know how everybody got together to write the Constitution? I mean, do you know how it was all pulled together? That meeting of founding fathers? 1786, 87. You know, we had been a federation prior to that, after winning the Revolutionary War. Well, you're about to find out, and it's fascinating. So, in 1788... there was a guy by the name of General Rufus Putnam. Remember Putnam? Connecticut, military, Revolutionary War hero. And he was then with the Ohio Company of Associates. And they had founded a river settlement in Illinois. And basically what they wanted to do was open up the West. You know, Putnam knew that Ohio and Illinois were the gateways to the West because he was a scholar, a historical scholar, and he had studied the French and Indian Wars. So he understood the geographical importance and the importance of the rivers in terms of commerce, transportation, and moving goods and people westward. The river near Marietta was so strategic, to give you an idea, that several years later when Aaron Burr, remember him? Aaron Burr killed Alexander Hamilton. When he hatched his treasonous plot to seize the West, which is a whole nother story that most folks don't know, his kickoff point was, in fact, at this spot along the river in Marietta. The bottom line, though, is that George Washington, you know, good old George, founder of America in a lot of ways, father of America in many ways, he wasn't yet president, right? We didn't have a republic. And he was wondering, as all good capitalists do, he was wondering how he could increase the value of his inheritance, which was called, as you know, Mount Vernon. And it sat right on the Potomac River. That's cool. But the problem is that the Potomac River at that time was like good for scenery. It wasn't good for shipping. It wasn't good for transit. It wasn't good for barges, moving goods, people, nothing. It was shallow. It was choppy. It just didn't work. So George talked to his cronies. His fellow founding fathers. And he talked them into backing a plan to make the Potomac, navigable, and extend that navigable portion right past his pal Putnam's intended metropolis on the Ohio at Marietta, and of course, by and through Mount Vernon. You know, Mount Vernon, connected to the river, connected to the West, connected to the capital, connected to this huge city that was going to be built as the gateway to the West, Marietta. I mean, it was quite a plan. They founded a company called the Potomac Company, not MAC, but MACK. And, you know, the Potomac went through a number of states. And as the states were wont to do in that day and age, as they are wont to do in this day and age, there's a lot of things that the states just can't agree on between themselves. You know, they all want the money, they all want the taxes, they all want the revenues, they all want the trade, the commerce, the jobs, and they're very jealous if any other state gets any more than they do. Nothing has changed, folks, in 230 plus years. It's all the same. Anyway, the states couldn't get along. They couldn't decide exactly how to improve the river, how to make it navigable, who's going to pay for what, who was going to get revenues from which, where it was going to go, who wasn't going to get the benefit, and on and on and on. Well, the one thing that did come out of this meeting of all these states to try and get this river thing worked out so that the Potomac Company could make a fortune building Marietta as the gateway to the West, and George could make a fortune with a piece of real estate called Mount Vernon that would double, triple, quadruple, who knows what in value. The really good thing that came out of all this squabbling between the states and the many meetings that were convened to try and figure out this river deal is that Alexander Hamilton noticed that all the states would come together for a common purpose when their interests were served. And he suggested, listen, we're all getting together to talk about this river deal and helping George and helping Potomac and helping Putnam. Why don't we get together and draft us a constitution? I'm not making this up. This is history. So the Conference on Rivers, as it was called, decided to become the Constitutional Convention. And, you know what came next? The Constitution of the United States. And some say, and I'm just kind of joking here, but some say that they made George, since the river deal never went through and Mount Vernon never increased in value and they felt bad, that's why they made him the first president. That's not history. That's just a joke. Anyway, I find that story rather fascinating. In the end, it was patriotism, but it was also self-interest, capitalism, and who knew who and what who was talking to who about when. Very interesting. Little has changed in human history, folks. The next thing I'm going to cover really quickly is Judicial Watch. I talk about them a lot. These guys rock, folks. They have single-handedly, along with some erstwhile reporters, very few, opened the can of worms that is the Hillary email scandal, the Benghazi scandal, the deep state Spygate scandal, Obama's, as we're going to be talking about, intertwining into all that nonsense. And, they are active in election integrity. As I told you in previous shows, they've sued a number of states to get them to purge their voter rolls. Almost 3 million. Think about that. 3 million improper names on voter rolls in four states. 3 million. The last election, putting aside that there was 5 million illegal votes cast by illegal aliens and who knows who, people voting in more than one place, people voting twice, three times, who knows what, ballot canvassing, I'm not going to go down that road. These guys are terrific. They are also deeply involved in uncovering the full, sordid truth about Hillary Clinton's email and foundation scandals. They are hard at work on sanctuary cities, getting it overturned, exposing them. They're hard at work at looking at the problems on the southern border with criminals and terrorists coming across. They are terrific. I believe there's an article on them posted by the producers under the treason section of articles this week. Let me urge you to send them some money. Maybe it's $10, maybe it's $30, maybe it's $50, maybe it's $100. Send these guys some dough. They are doing yeoman's work on behalf of you, this country, and the Constitution. All right. Let's move on to the hearings with Bill Barr, the new Attorney General. And I don't know how many of you got to watch those hearings. I'm sure you've heard in one way, shape, or form the fallout from them. I mean, basically, the Democratic senators were absolutely outrageous. In fact, they weren't outrageous, they were idiotic. And I'm not saying that, because the Democratic Communist Party makes me gag, it does. But you would think that there would be some intelligent questioning that had some kind of meaning, that had some kind of relevance to what's really important, like, how are we going to stop Russian interference, and in fact, any foreign interference in our election processes in the future? Gee, that question didn't come up other than from a few Republicans. How are we going to ensure the sanctity of one person, one citizen, one vote. That certainly didn't come up because that's not their game plan at all. I mean, it was outrageous. And I got to tell you that I watched, and I do this often, and I tell you folks about this, many times more than what is said is the expressions and body language of he or she who is speaking. And I watched Bill Barr very closely as they were pounding away, calling him a liar and, you know, incompetent and a cover-up artist and a lackey of the press. I mean, you know, the list is endless. And his eyes, when he first started, were kind of wide open behind his glasses. And his hands were mostly folded in front of him or working with papers in front of him. And as the hearing went on, his eyes got narrower and narrower and narrower. And his hands, instead of being on the desk, were more and more often either over his mouth, supporting his chin, in some way concealing his real facial expressions and attitude as to what was going on. And there were a few things he did verbally, too. Blumenthal, that moron from Connecticut, you know, Mr. Vietnam lying vet, he asked him, "Oh, can you give us the notes of this telecom with Mueller?" Barr was great. He didn't hesitate at all. He just goes, "No." You should have seen Blumenthal's face. I almost fell out of my chair laughing. He was like, "What?" It was truly precious. And there was another time he was talking about Mueller's letter. I'm going to talk about that here in just a moment. Tie it in for you. Where there was a very telltale comment by him. He said, "Yes, well, the letter was snitty." You know, if you've watched Bill Barr over the years, I mean, this guy is an old grizzly bear, and one with a intellect far superior than any of the morons that he was dealing with, who knows the law 10 times better than any of the attorneys, so-called, that are in Congress, whether it's Senate or the House of Representatives. And here's what I came away with. First of all the screaming and yelling about by the Democrats, the cover-up, the this, the that, and, you know, the letter from Mueller that he received March 27th after his March 24th letter, and, you know, he concealed it from Chris Holland, and on and on and on. Let me give you the real truth. Because Democrats lie. Well, all politicians lie. Democrats lie on purpose. I mean, they don't fib. They just flat out lie. Because the means justifies the ends. Thank you, Saul Alinsky. Or in the Muslim sense, since they're all tied in, the Muslim sense, I believe, is taqiyya. I can never pronounce it. But it is the sanctioning of lying to an infidel to advance the ultimate caliphate of Muhammad. Totally permissible. In fact, you get a backslap from your fellow Muslims. Means justifies the end. How close Muhammad and Alinsky really were. So let's start at the beginning. Mueller, who is Barr's supposed longtime 30-year friend, he concludes his report mysteriously just 2 weeks after Barr is sworn in. I don't think that was a coincidence. We come to find out that Mueller knew that there was no collusion for at least a year, this is really important, prior to concluding his report. Now, one of the things which kind of strikes me about that is what exactly was Mueller doing other than sucking on the government teat for his outrageous salary and the salary of his 19 Democrat staff attorney members, other than trying to set the president up for an obstruction of justice charge? I mean, the more time that went, the more he knew Trump would be frustrated, the more likely it was Trump would do something stupid. And in the meantime, Mueller's getting paid. Gee. How can you lose? Anyway, Mueller releases his report. So that you're clear, under the current special counsel law, which was insisted upon and passed by Democrats, including Nadler, that vicious, nasty head of the Judiciary Committee in the House of Representatives, an attorney general does not have to release one comma, not one period, not one word of a special counsel's investigation. Period. Nada. None. As Barr told them in the confirmation hearings, 2 weeks prior to Mueller concluding his report, he was going to release everything he could, other than, another important point, grand jury information, which by law cannot be released without a court order. And number two, any intelligence information which would reveal sources, uses, and put assets, people, in jeopardy. So the report gets released. Within a week or so of its release, on March 24th, Barr writes his famous 4-page letter. Let me emphasize this. You can read the letter yourself. It's online. It is not a summary of the report. It is a summary of the conclusions of the report, which A, was absolutely no collusion, and B, obstruction Mueller did not take a stand on. He listed reasons it should be obstruction and listed reasons it shouldn't be obstruction. That in itself is a violation of Mueller's marching orders under the law. A prosecutor does not exonerate. A prosecutor either prosecutes or does not. The very fact that Mueller, after 2 years and, you know, the litany of witnesses, and we're talking about, you know, thousands of subpoenas, interviews, you name it, 19 attorneys, 40 FBI, and on and on and on. The fact that he could not put together a case to indict Trump on obstruction of justice, despite the little crumbs out there that he mentions improperly in his report, means there was no obstruction of justice. Because if Bob Mueller could have indicted Trump or had a finding that there was obstruction, trust me, he would have done it in a heartbeat. The second thing that Mueller did in not doing that was to set up his so-called good friend of 30 years, Barr. I mean, Mueller, folks, and I've said this many times, is a dirty cop. He's an ingrained splinter in the wood of the deep state. I don't care what his military service and all the great things he did up to the time that he became a mole in the deep state was. The guy is now, and at that time, probably when he was appointed by Barack Obama, 15 whatever years ago, as head of the FBI, the guy is a dirty cop. So he sets up his friend Barr, because basically what he does is he forces Barr, as Attorney General, brand new, to make a decision along with Rod Rosenstein as to whether these things, pro and con, in the report amount to obstruction of justice, and further, if they amount to indictable, in other words, you can prove beyond a reasonable doubt, obstruction of justice. So he puts Barr on the spot, and he puts the American people on the spot, and he gives the Democrats something to jump up and down and moan about by leaving this open-ended, by not doing his job, by a dereliction of duty, plain and simple. And he achieved many things by doing it. About a week after Barr gets the report, goes over it with a bunch of DOJ attorneys and Rosenstein, and they determine that there was no obstruction of justice, at least no chargeable obstruction of justice. They come out with their 4-page summary of conclusions on March 24th. What most folks don't know is that Barr contacted Mueller, whom he thought was his friend, 4 or 5 days prior to issuing the March 24th letter and offered Mueller the chance to review the draft and make any comments he wished. Gee, wouldn't you know that Mueller declined? Ha! Huh. Imagine that. So Barr comes out with his letter. You're well aware of the tempest that that created. You know, the Democrats jumping up and down. And, you know, he didn't tell us everything and so on and so forth. And Barr testifies at the House of Representatives in the Judiciary Committee. And Chris Van Hollen asks him a question. You know, does Bob Mueller have any problems with the conclusions? You got to read Van Hollen's question. With the conclusions in your letter. And Barr goes, no. Flash forward just about 3 weeks. I think it was April 15th. As Barr promised, he releases the entire report, including the 19-page summary that Mueller drafted, including all 200 pages of, we'll call it, Volume 1, which dealt with collusion, zero, and Volume 2, 200 and some odd pages, plus pages, which dealt with obstruction of justice, no conclusion. Barr took that ball, ran with it, said no obstruction. The redactions, less than 10% of the first 200 pages, the collusion, is redacted. Less than 1%, that's 1%, of the second 200 plus pages, which should have never been written by a prosecutor who couldn't find enough to indict, was redacted. So Congress now has, and the American people, you can read the whole thing online. So Congress now has, and the American people have, literally, the full report. Contrary to, and he has the right to do it, the regulations of the DOJ, which says you don't release the report and you don't have to release anything. So Barr makes good on all his promises. He does it exactly when he says it's going to do. And in fact, he furnishes more of the report than anybody expected, given the strict legal limitations on sources and uses, you know, redacting sources and uses and redacting any of those matters which could be considered grand jury testimony. What most people don't know is that he could have gotten it out probably within days of his March 24th letter. But gee, Bob Mueller and his team of 60 that we paid $30 million for after 2 years and drafting this report for God only knows how long, at least a year, they didn't bother to redact anything. Zero. So Barr and Rosenstein, and I'm no fan of Rosenstein, but Barr and Rosenstein are given a totally unredacted report marked at the bottom, this page, each page, every single page of the 400 plus pages marked at the bottom by Mueller, this page contains classified and confidential information. Now, I guess you could chalk it up to incompetence, but I don't think so. Not in the whole context of this sordid story I'm relaying to you, and I think the only person in the press kind of laying it out, boom, 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 step by step. On March 27th, although nobody knew it till just a few days ago, Mueller, rather than picking up the phone and calling his 30-year friend to discuss the fact that Mueller's dereliction of duty in finding and making a finding on obstruction of justice, and rather than picking up the phone saying, you know, I wish I had read that 4-page letter you did before you did when you offered it, but I didn't, and I'd sure like some corrections here. Well, Barr cleverly puts together a confab of people in his office. Several DOJ attorneys, Rosenstein, their staffs, you name it. I mean, a whole bunch of witnesses, which I'm quite sure he did on purpose. Because although he didn't say it other than that one comment about the letter was snitty, I think he was pissed, he was upset, he was surprised, and he realized maybe for the first time that his so-called friend Mueller was not his friend and was really a dirty cop, deep state mole, a swamp dweller. He calls up Mueller. This was the day after he received the letter, the 28th. And he said, how come you didn't call me? And he asked Mueller in front of all these witnesses, do you have any problems with the conclusions I reached in my letter? That there is no collusion and there is no obstruction. And Mueller said no. Mueller instead said, the problem I have is that you didn't release enough of the context of the report. And you should have released our 19-page summary with yours or whatever. To put this in perspective, folks, Mueller works for Barr. Mueller is an employee of the Department of Justice while he's a special counsel sucking $30 million out of our taxpayers' bloodlines. Barr doesn't work for him. The ultimate and absolute authority on how to deal with this report, whether or not to release it, all or in part, what to say about it, you name it, is William Barr's, not Bob Mueller's. You know, the white knight of the Democrats. After this conversation, supposedly there is a second letter then sent by Mueller, also snitty, saying, well, you know, I still think you should be releasing more of the report, etc., etc. And Barr basically told him, I'm not releasing anything more. I've made my decision. I'm sure Barr by this time had figured out exactly the game that Mueller was playing because, you know, the Democrats are jumping up and down at the same time. Everything's coordinated, you know. I mean, there are no coincidences. And he said, I'm going to release the entire report, buddy Bob, and that will take care of your concerns about what's been released and what's not. And sure enough, on April 15th, Barr releases the entire report. So now, in the public domain, and available to every member of Congress who wants to read it, is Barr's four-page letter, the 19-page summary by Mueller, and Mueller's entire report virtually unredacted. In addition, you probably didn't know this, Barr sets up a secure reviewing room, which is how they handle like really top-secret classified stuff, so that anybody, let me underline this, anybody in Congress, in the investigating committees at a certain level, the ranking member, the chairman, you name it, can go down to the secure viewing room and view an unredacted, zero, no redactions, copy of everything, including the report, Mueller's 19-page summary, you name it. As of the Senate hearings, 2 days ago, Thursday, as of the Senate hearings, three representatives from all of Congress, out of the 535 or whatever it is, senators and congressmen, had bothered to go down to the secure viewing room and read either the report or the unredacted portions of the report. All three were Republicans. All three. The ranking member of the Judiciary or Intelligence Committee in the House, Republican. Mitch McConnell, Republican. And Lindsey Graham, chairman of the Intelligence Committee in the Senate. Not a single Democrat, not Nadler, not any of the disgusting morons questioning Barr and casting all sorts of insinuations, aspersions, and what have you at this attorney general on Thursday, not a single one of them bothered to go down and read the report. In fact, watching their antics, watching their gag me performance, I'm not sure that any of them had even read the redacted version of the report. I think they had their staff do it and they were reading off of note cards. It was pathetic. Just pathetic. But I'm not done, as they say on late night TV. There's more. Don't go away. So now the Democrats, oh, God, I forgot the most important part. The night before the hearing, the afternoon before the Thursday hearing, gee, guess what? The Washington Post and the New York Times get a leak. Huh, how could that happen? Where could that come from? And the leak is the two letters that Mueller sent to Barr, that Barr had had phone conversations with Mueller concerning, as I've just relayed to you. And the New York Times and the Washington Post, literally on the eve of the Senate hearings, Wednesday night, come out with this huge story. Barr conceals letter from Mueller. Mueller upset with Barr's summary. Mueller calls Barr's summary inaccurate, and, you know, whatever. Whatever the made-up fake news drumbeat was. Never mentioning these phone calls that there are notes of, that there are buku witnesses to. And Barr provides those two letters with all this flack running around and all the breathless, oh my God, we got him now, by the left-wing media, which is the entire media. And he goes into the Senate hearing, and they jump all over him. And he keeps trying to explain to them. I mean, the guy had like the patience of a saint, although I will tell you, his eyes were getting narrower and narrower, and the hands were more and more and more around his chin and his mouth, trying to explain to them, I had this phone conversation with Mueller. And Mueller had no problem with my conclusions. His problem was there wasn't enough context, and the press was overplaying, should we say, the background. And these senators, they just didn't want to hear it. I mean, they just, it was friggin' unbelievable. It was embarrassing. I sat there as an American. Never mind, you know, they're Democrat. I mean, never mind all that. I sat there as an American thinking about how somebody in England or France or Poland or Israel would be watching this circus, this charade, unparalleled exhibition of incompetence and what they would be thinking about the United States. Wow. That's all I can tell you. It's just wow. So now the Democratic senators are accusing Barr during the hearing of concealing the letters, and his four-page summary is inaccurate. Now remember, folks, the report, the entire report, including unredacted, sitting in a room waiting for their viewing, that they didn't do, has been available for 2 weeks. You know, Bill Barr could have written in his March 24th letter that Mickey Mouse was from Mars, and it doesn't matter. Only the report, and if you want to go that far, Mueller's summary matters, all of which are available, all of which speak for themselves. And all of which, by the way, substantiate exactly what Barr wrote on March 24th, which were not a summary of the report, but a summary of the conclusions. He had a great moment. He had a bunch of great moments. He was terrific. But he had a great moment when he very patiently, like he was instructing a first-year law student, and he was dean of the law school, he said, look, this is like a jury renders a verdict, and I'm the defense counsel, and the prosecutor comes up to me afterwards, after I have a press conference, and saying the jury's verdict was X, and says, well, the jury's verdict was X, but you didn't tell them about my great cross-examination of this witness and this wonderful piece of evidence I had over here. That was his analogy, and it was great. It was right on. It was terrific. And, you know, they didn't want to, I don't think they got it, and I don't think they wanted to get it if they could have gotten it. Now, let's keep going, because this little sordid tale is not over. The bottom line is that Barr's letter of March 24th was spot on accurate. It was a letter of conclusions, not a letter of inclusions. Mueller has now been exposed for what I've always known he was, and what he truly is, a dirty deep state cop and a lackey of the Democratic, well, lackey of the establishment for sure, and of the Democratic establishment in this case positively. He threw Barr under the bus. I don't think Barr was expecting it. And I don't think Barr's happy about it. And I think... Oh, one of the things I got to tell you. One of the absolute best examples of insane stupidity was Kamala Harris, who I don't like at all. In her snooty, aloof, nasty, slept her way to the top way. Oh, gee, did I say that? Well, that's what she did. Slept her way to the top way. She's pounding on Barr saying, well, when you reached your conclusions, because she saw the intelligence in his argument didn't go there. When you reached your conclusions, had you seen all the underlying evidence? And Barr kind of looked at her like, what? She goes, all the underlying evidence. Folks, the underlying evidence, 2,800 subpoenas, 50 or 100 or whatever it is, phone taps, 19 attorneys, 40 FBI, all writing reports. I don't know how many millions and millions, not thousands, millions and millions of pages of documents. And she was actually asking the Attorney General of the United States, A, did you review it all before you made your conclusions? And B, she was clearly insinuating, and nobody else in the press has caught this, that Bob Mueller can't be trusted. That Mueller must have lied in his report. That the evidence that Mueller had, these, you know, warehouse full of evidence that nobody could have reviewed within 2 weeks anyway, even if you were a Superman, that all this evidence would bring us to a different conclusion than Mueller, who had been like her, you know, white knight just weeks ago, had reached. I mean, it was really a pathetic display. She was basically asking Barr to take the position that everything that Mueller wrote was wrong, incomplete, and untrue. And Barr was very clear. He said, listen, my evidence was Mueller's report. What he didn't say was, I'm not going back and reading a warehouse full of papers, lady. That's what you just spent $30 million and employed like 70 people for 2 years to do. I don't need to do it again. So I want you to understand exactly what's going on here. Because this is made up, contrived, nasty, treasonous stuff that's occurring. It's outrageous. And then the Democrats, just in the last day or so, they're talking about, because Barr wisely decided not to show up for the House of Representatives hearing, which was scheduled for yesterday, and Nadler changed the rules. By the way, along those lines, Nadler wanted the staff attorneys for the Judiciary Committee to pose questions to Barr. And, you know, the Democrats are saying, oh, this is an unusual and the usual nonsense. Let me tell you how unusual this is. In the entire history of the United States Congress, going back 226, 7, whatever it is, years, no staff member, attorney or otherwise, of the Judiciary Committee of the United States Congress has ever posed a question or interviewed a witness ever, period. So to say that there is no precedence and that this is highly unusual and suspect and flies in the face of 2 centuries plus of tradition is an understatement. Although Nadler lies about it continuously. And then Nadler says, well, if you don't show up, I'm going to throw you in contempt. Folks, once again, I don't know how gullible they think the public is, and I suppose All the lefties that are sitting there watching this with their mouths open, sure that Mueller was in a conspiracy with Barr and all the evidence will point to something, I mean, all the crap. Barr was going to testify and answer any and all questions posed to him by the Congress people whom the Americans have elected, just like we've done it since the very first day there was a Congress and the very first day there was a Judiciary Committee for two plus centuries. He volunteered to go to the hearing on Friday, and he refused only when Nadler changed the rules, which he can't do. When you volunteer, this is like a really basic point, but, you know, the Democrats obviously think that everybody is really stupid. When you volunteer to be a witness at a congressional hearing, and then you decline for any reason, never mind the fact that the substance of the hearing has been materially altered, you're not in contempt. And if you're not in contempt because you simply don't show up to what was voluntary to begin with, you can't be cited for contempt. I know, you know, just a minor matter, but I thought I'd bring up the reality for everybody since nobody else in the media seems to want to do it. And that brings us to, now that we've talked about how nasty the Democrats are, how oblivious they are to the, shall we say, collusion hoax-weary country that they're supposed to be, that they get paid by and that they're supposed to be working for, and how influenced they are by alt-left, and in some cases, Islamist ideology. That brings us perfectly into our gal Omar. You know, our little Muslim Congress lady from Minnesota, whose election was predicated on refugees being concentrated by Barry Obama from a Somali in the 5th Minnesota District. I've given you a show on this. In the last week, while all this is going on, Omar, I'm going to paraphrase, Omar has been blasting out the fact that America has no right to be involved whatsoever or interfering in any way, shape, or form in Venezuela, that Maduro, the dictator who's killed umpteen people, who starves his people, who doesn't allow food aid in, is a great guy, and we should leave him alone, and finally, that all the suffering in Venezuela, starving people, disease, 3 million people that have left the country, you name it, is all the fault of the United States. Never mind the fact that there's 20,000 Cuban troops there and several thousand Russian advisors and at least 200 Marines, Russian Marines. And there are no, I'm sure there's covert actors for the United States, but there are no United States troops there, but it is all the fault of America. Never mind the Monroe Doctrine, which has stood this country in great stead since President Monroe basically made it ongoing policy, and that is America would not allow third-party influences anywhere in the northern or southern hemisphere, which is done for strategic reason. You have Iran in Venezuela. And let's see, what does Iran do? Oh, that's right. Iran is building nuclear bombs, thanks, Barry. And Iran is testing ballistic missiles. And Iran has a missile that can now go 700 to 900 miles. And how far is Venezuela from the United States? Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. But we should do nothing. And it's all our fault. And the people of Venezuela should hate us. And that great guy Maduro who runs the country, we should leave the poor guy alone. That was one of Omar's amazing observations this week. The second was that America is doomed to fail, that America deserves to fail, that she wants America to fail, and that she wants all white people in America to fail, die, or go away. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but this is exactly what she meant. Her exact words were something like, soon, the United States will no longer be the land of white people. And it goes on from there. I believe those articles are posted under scandal, treason, Unholy Alliance, and Alt Left. There's a bunch of them. You should read them. You should read what this congresswoman, fully supported by Tlaib from Michigan, by four or five other alt-left Islamists scattered around Nancy Pelosi's Democratic House, Democratic Communist House, and the bug-eyed babe from the Bronx, AOC, with their full support. And by the way, after she came out with those little bleeps, and after Tlaib and AOC said, oh yeah, she's right on, man. She has it pegged. She knows what's going on. Ooh, yeah, she's our hero. Guess who praised the three of them? In writing. Across the internet. Big, bold letters. Repeatedly. Oh, that's right, that little group. Well, what's their name? We should ask Barry. He could tell. Oh, that's right, ISIS. Does that give you an idea just how nasty, how anti-American these people are? Wow. The only good thing about them is that, you know, they're out in the open. And I just don't think it's going to help them much in 2020. All right. That brings us to our main event. Rat-a-tat-a-tat. Drumbeat, please. Who is Barack Hussein Obama? Before we get into our friend Barry and his sordid associations and past, all of them dark for America, I just wanted to remind you, 2 years ago I told you that this was going to boomerang on the Democrats, that all these bad players, all these bad cops, all these treason meisters, Brennan and Clapper and Comey and Baker, all of them, by the way, Obama appointees. Think about that. Every single one of them, Obama appointees. You'll see why here in just a moment as we open up our crown jewel, our big segment for the night. I told you that bad stuff was going to come down on them, and it's coming down. And let me tell you, this Barr hearing, you could almost hear the wheels turning in Bill Barr's mind as they kept poking the bear, the big old legal grizzly bear. And they just kept poking and poking. And, you know, as those eyes narrowed, you could see this determination. I mean, I could feel it. And when questioned by some of the Republicans, he was emphatic. Are you going to investigate the Hillary email? Yes. Are you going to investigate the spying? Yes. Are you going to investigate the FISA warrants? Yes. I mean, all these people are in for such a bad time and so well deserved, and the country so needs it. And the Constitution demands it. The second thing that I kind of wanted to bring to your attention is that the Democrats wouldn't be able to stop themselves. They're kind of helpless in their own emotions and their own BS. You know, they kind of believe their own nonsense because they say it so often. The typical pathological liar. And they don't get where this is going. I mean, in a way, they kind of do. All this that you see going on right now, yes, it's a last desperate attempt to try and get Trump somehow, some way, unknown, throw spaghetti at the wall and see if it sticks. But what this really is, this is the last line of defense against what they know now is coming. And that is a tsunami of justice, a tidal wave of indictments. All their favorite sons, all their deep state cronies, they're all going down. And given what's coming to light through Judicial Watch and others, I think it's going to reach way higher than it is now, at least to Lynch, quite possibly to Jarrett, and quite possibly to Obama. As I told you in previous shows, I was originally at 40-60, it would go that high. Now I'm at 60-40. And the more you poke that bear, the more you poke Bill Barr, the higher it's going to go and the uglier it's going to get. because those dumb demos, those dumb Democrats, they poked the bear and they absolutely enraged him. And you know, you never want to be on the same trail as a grizzly that's pissed off. And that's the trail they're on. Let's see. There was one other thing I wanted to kind of remind you of, too. So, I told you 4 or 5 years ago that Benghazi would never be over. And what you're going to see evolving now is, in one way, shape, or form, all coming out of Benghazi and the acts and lack of acts of Obama, there he is again, and Clinton. It was Benghazi that originally uncovered Clinton's email server that eventually led to her obstruction of justice, destroying 33,000 emails and pounding cell phones, etc. That then led just 2 weeks ago to the discovery of Hillary's emails in Barack Obama's archives in the Oval Office. And on and on and on. You know, those poor four Americans that died that night. Those two up on the roof calling for help that never came. They're about to be avenged, as is the honor of the nation. So, let's get into Barry. I think you will find, and if we don't reach it all this morning, we're going to come back to it next week. And next week, by the way, I got a gangbuster show. Part of it's on healthcare. And the reality behind this Medicare for All nonsense. I mean, you know, wow. 2 plus 2 is 4, guys. You know, it's not 3, it's not 2, it's not 5. Water runs downhill. It's pretty simple stuff. But you will be aghast at the reality behind what these morons are proposing on this Medicare for All. And we're also going to be doing part 4, I believe it is, either part 4 or part 5 of our Civilizational Jihad series. We're about to get into part 4, which is, who is Barack Obama? So, and next week, by the way, on that part 5, we're going to be talking about all the steps that Barack Obama and his minions took to deprive you of freedoms and liberties to further their ideology, self-power, and gain. You'll be shocked, and you'll recognize some of those acts and lack of acts that they took that affected you and your family in all sorts of ways. And now you'll understand more about them, and you'll understand why they were undertaken. It wasn't incompetence, it was intentional. So let's talk about Barry Obama. A riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. That's really what he is. Has there ever been a president, folks, think about it, whose personal history is so murky, so questionable, so baffling? You know, to this day, the birth certificate thing is not cleared up. He has a grandmother and a brother who swear he was born in Kenya. A brother who has a birth certificate who says it's the original. A birth certificate in Hawaii with a social security number that originates in Connecticut, where he's never gone or been or lived. And the birth certificate in Hawaii, the gal who typed it up, was the only fatality in a mysterious crash of an 8-seater plane. If you remember back to my show, 2 or 3 years ago, about all the people that died who were close to Hillary, and how 8 of those 52 deaths, at that time 47, 8 were in small planes. I mean, what are the odds of that? And here's this gal who did the supposed Hawaii birth certificate for Barack Obama. Just doesn't make it out of private plane crash. Everybody else does, though. Everybody else does. I want you to think about this. If you have a situation like we have over the last 2 or 3 years, Obama gate, spy gate, deep state gate, whatever you want to call it, where Barack Obama knew about, oversaw, and directed this intricate hoax, this intricate plot. Oh, my producer's nodding at me. Yeah, I'm saying that Barack Obama knew about it and oversaw it. I'm just going, listen, that's what Peter Strzok's texts say. POTUS wants to know everything we're doing. We know about the meeting in the Oval Office on January 7th, prior to the inauguration, with Clapper and Comey and all those people there. This happened. Barry was in the middle of it. Barry was directing it. That's why Susan Rice wrote the CYA letter the day of Trump's inauguration. Everything Barack Obama did in that January 7th, he said, we have to do it by the book. I mean, why would you write a letter to yourself saying that? 2 weeks after a meeting on the day the new president is inaugurated. Yeah, okay. If they could pull off all that, you don't think they could pull off hiding somebody's real background? Hiding somebody's real birthplace? Just ask yourself that rhetorical question. A 1991 promotional literary pamphlet featured a biographical sketch of Obama and claimed, quote, I quote, born in Kenya and raised in Indonesia and Hawaii, end quote. Flash forward to 2015. The Speaker of the Kenyan Parliament says Barack Obama, our native son, born here in Kenya and now the President of the United States. What is Barack Obama's actual name, do you know? I call him Barry. There's only one publicly available school record for Obama, and it lists him as an Indonesian citizen, not an American citizen, named Barry Sotero, hence my loving name for Barack Obama, Barry. There's an immigration document from 1965. Obama's mother included the name Sobarka, S-O-E-B-A-R-K-A-H, under Barack Hussein Obama. This is a name, by the way, that was given to him, likely, by the Islamic cult of Subud, S-U-B-U-D, to which his mom proudly and openly belonged. Gee, where's the press on this, right? Where's our media? Where's our investigative reporters over there at ABC, NBC, etc., etc.? Obama's Social Security number begins with the prefix 042, which is Connecticut, a state in which Obama has never lived. His academic records, you've probably heard rumors about these. Supposedly, he attended three universities, Occidental College, Columbia University, and Harvard University. His academic records with these three institutions have never, underline never, been revealed. And many, many, many investigative reporters and others have tried to get them. The student body present at Columbia University during Obama's time there, Wayne Allen Root, I've interviewed him on this show. And by the way, he was a libertarian candidate for president. I'm sorry, vice presidential candidate, thanks for the correction, has stated publicly, that he never met or even heard of Obama while at Columbia. Can't find any classmates of his who remember him either. By the way, Root, like Obama, at the same time, purportedly, was a political science major. Obama, when he was campaigning for president, presented himself as a professor of constitutional law while at the University of Chicago. That was a lie, and that was proven to be a lie. Of course, the press didn't do anything about it. He was a senior lecturer, way, way, way below the rank of professor. and significantly less prestigious than a professor, by the way. Obama's birth certificate. Obama's birthplace has always been in contention, folks. He insisted he was born in Honolulu, Hawaii, 1961. But there are a number of folks who claim, including his family, his grandmother and his brother, who claim he was born in Mombasa, Kenya. And a number of these people say that the long-form birth certificate that he finally produced, that was ostensibly drafted by this gal in Hawaii, who was mysteriously the only fatality in this small plane crash, was a forgery. So, at best, we have, should we say, inconsistent biographical records of Barry Obama. And, you know, what's the next best thing to determine who somebody really is? His acts, his lack of acts, and who are his friends? So let's take a look at Barack Obama's friends. And once again, I've had bits and pieces of this in other shows on Obama. You can type Obama in the search bar on the website, and those shows will come up. You can listen to them. This is not the first time I've been beating this drum, but this is the most extensive time by far. So, Paul Kenger wrote a book, K-E-N-G-O-R, The Communist. And it was about a guy by the name of Frank Marshall Davis, a known Soviet communist, admirer of Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler, who, by the way, was a lefty, and a really good friend of Obama's mother's father, Stanley Dunham, one of the grandparents that raised Obama. Davis lived in both Hawaii and in Chicago. Gee, interesting, isn't it? And he was Barack Obama's mentor through the 1970s until his departure, ostensibly, for Occidental College in 1979. Davis, by the way, was also a pornographer. I mean, that's not reported much, particularly by the left. He wrote a book, Sex Rebel, and he talked about having sex with minors in the book. You can look it up for yourself. Pedophilia, by the way, was not uncommon for communists of that era. It's not uncommon for communists of this era either. Just ask any of the folks in Hollywood. Harry Hay, who is another communist, an associate of Davis, was reportedly an advocate of NAMBLA, the National Man-Boy Love Association. Can't make this stuff up. In 1995, on a broadcast on Cambridge Municipal Television, Barack Obama described Davis, quote, as a close friend of my maternal grandfather, a close friend of Gramps, and a fairly, find the rest of the quote here, and a fairly, God, I got so much papers all over here, known poet. That's how Barry described him. The historical facts, folks, not surmise, establish that his primary political mentor was a Soviet communist sex offender introduced to him by his alt-left mother's family. Let me tell you about another friend of his, a guy by the name of George Soros. Now, I've done a show on George Soros and his background. I've done shows on George Soros and his slimy, anti-American, treasonous, moneyed tentacles that spread out to 187 organizations actively working to bring down the Constitution, America, the values, and fundamentally transform the country. So, as a brief refresher, George Soros, a.k.a. Georgie, that's G-Y-O-R-G-Y, Schwartz, is a Hungarian-born, now a billionaire, financier. You know, his organizations, his main organizations through which he funnels most of his money is the Open Society Foundation, Acorn, boy, remember that name. And by the way, Barack Obama was, before doing any of this college stuff, was an organizer, a community organizer for ACORN. Another link. Think Progress, the Center for American Progress, Code Pink, Occupy Wall Street, National Council of La Raza, the Tides Foundation, MoveOn.org, the New America Foundation, the International Crisis Group, etc., etc., etc. As one history buff, shall we say, well-known historian, wrote, I'll quote, essentially, the entire leftist wing of the Democratic Party, including the president, can be tied to George Soros in some way. Soros was born in 1930, Budapest, Germany, Jewish. He grew up during the war in Hungary. He was a Nazi collaborator who turned other Jews over to the Nazi authorities and, by the way, helped Nazis take Jewish possessions, sell them who knows what. Soros, in an interview with 60 Minutes, reporter Steve Croft, shows no remorse for these actions at all, folks. In fact, I quote, the happiest time of my life, unquote. I think it kind of gives you an insight into the Soros psyche. Soros crashed the British pound when he made a bet it would correct against the douche mark in 1992. In 1999, Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, blocked a $500 million loan by the U.S. Import-Export Bank to the Russian oil company Tyumen. Tyumen planned to acquire one of Soros' companies with the money, by the way. Amazing. A few months later, suddenly Albright changed her mind and approved the loan. This happened again in 2009. The U.S. Import-Export Bank announced a, quote, preliminary commitment to loan $2 billion to the Brazilian oil giant Petrobras. I've had this on my shows. Soros, a major shareholder in Petrobras, profited very nicely under Obama's reign and the approval of that loan to Petrobras. Now remember, the loan was approved by Obama and Obama's administration at the same time Obama was shutting down all American offshore drilling. But at the same time, his government is approving a $2 billion loan to Petrobras from Brazil, who's drilling offshore and in which his buddy Soros has a big stake. In 2002, Soros was prosecuted by the French for insider trading. In 2012, Russia issued an arrest warrant for Soros. Obama's foreign policy and Arab Spring, we've talked about this in the previous segments, are all intertwined with Soros' interests, folks. In 2008, the International Crisis Group, aka ICG, a Soros front, issued a paper that urged the Egyptian government to allow the Muslim Brotherhood. Gee, we've just been talking about them. Imagine that. And we've been talking about the fact that Barry is likely a Muslim brother in the Brotherhood. Imagine that. Anyway, issued a paper that urged the Egyptian government to allow the Muslim Brotherhood to form a political party. The Muslim Brotherhood did form a political party. That political party was actively involved in terrorism, assassinations, all sorts of things, and eventually that party surreptitiously and illegally gained control until the Egyptian people, Mubarak, remember Mubarak, who was the leader of Egypt, and he was kind of he was the heir apparent. He was the guy who took over after Anwar Sadat. And between the two of them, they maintained a Mideast peace with Israel. Suddenly, the Muslim Brotherhood was in, and Mubarak was out. All under Barack Obama and financed and manipulated by George Soros. The ICG, by the way, the International Crisis Group, a Soros-funded outfit, the same outfit that wanted to see the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, was also kind of home to the ambassador. Ambassador Thomas Pickering. And who was he? Oh, he was Barry Obama's lead investigator from Benghazi. Wow, imagine that. And Robert Malley. Robert Malley's an interesting dude. He was appointed by Obama to a real high up, a real prominent position to lead Middle East policy, even though he was directly connected to Hamas. In a 2011 op-ed, Soros refers to himself, or refers to Israel, excuse me, not Hamas, as the stumbling block in Mideast peace. In the same piece, 2011, Soros encourages the Muslim Brotherhood to be given a seat at the table in Egyptian political life and urged Obama to support the Arab Spring overthrow of Mubarak. Do you guys see how all this ties in, folks? And can you see the evolution here of the alt-left and Islamists? How this unholy alliance is rapidly melding, growing stronger, tentacles spreading from one to the other. Let's take a look at some more friends of Barry's. How about Bill Ayers and Bernardine Dorn? In the 1960s, Ayers and Dorn were arrested for. They were notorious radicals, anarchists, terrorists. Publicly declared enemies of American society. So it is Ayers and Dorn, folks, who hosted the meet and greet fundraiser for candidate Obama when he first ran for public office. Yes. In fact, Obama's entire political career, beginning as a state senator, Illinois state senator, was launched from the couple's living room in Hyde Park, Chicago. Amazing how all this stuff links in. Let's take a look at the Ayers. So Bill Ayers' father was Tom Ayers, president of Commonwealth Edison, you know, the big power company in Chicago. The Ayers family was very close to the whole corrupt daily political machine in Chicago. Bill was, had all sorts of privilege. I mean, he'd be the definition of white privilege if you believed in that. And they had a connection to power production with the Chicago Climate Exchange. I don't have time to get into that this morning, but it's something we're going to delve into later. So anyway, Bill Ayers loved terrorism and revolution from like an early age. In 1969, he and Dorn, his girlfriend, and other radicals founded the Weather Underground. So this group of anarchists would claim responsibilities for targets and deaths, by the way, that included police, an ROTC building, the home of a judge, New York City police headquarters, and the Pentagon. So Dorn and Ayers were on the run. They were fugitives. They eventually married. And because of some technical flaws in their prosecutions, neither one of these treasonous anarchists who killed people and who launched Barry Obama's career ever served one day in jail. Not a day in jail. The couple, by the way, has two sons. Guess what they're named? Islamic names. Zayd, Z-A-Y-D, and Malik, M-A-L-I-K. What are the chances? There are no coincidences. And Ayers, by the way, has admitted twice, not once, twice, that he authored Obama's memoir, Dreams of My Father, a story of race and inheritance, which was published in 1995. I've talked about it a number of times. In fact, you can type it in the search bar, Dreams of My Father. It's very telling. And by the way, folks, if you haven't read it, don't buy it new, because you don't want Barry getting one dime of your money. Buy it used, but read Dreams of My Father. You can listen to all this stuff, this thought process, this thought train, this anti-American cancer that grows somewhere in Barry Obama's heart and mind, in his own words. You don't have to listen to mine. September 11th, 2001. Ayers publishes a memoir called Fugitive Days. Let me give you one quote from his book. This, by the way, was printed by the New York Times on September 11th, 2001, 911. Quote, "Everything was absolutely ideal on the day I bombed the Pentagon, and I feel we didn't do enough." Unquote. Let's talk about Dorn, his wife. She has been, until 1991-2013, a professor at Northwestern Law School. Wow. I hope none of you listeners here has wasted your money sending your kids there for a law degree. Do you remember Sharon Tate? Remember that poor actress and her friends in Hollywood, Charlie Manson, and his cult murdered them all, and one of the crazed helter-skelter crowd stuck a fork in Sharon Tate's pregnant belly. Do you remember that? Here's what Dorn wrote about that. I quote, "Dig it. First they killed those pigs, and then they put a fork in that pig Tate's belly. Wild." Unquote. What a peach. What a peach. Starting after 9-1-1, 2001, the World Trade Center destruction, Dorn and Ayers kind of saw kindred spirits, and they began to openly associate with Islamic terrorists. They were involved in the 2010 Peace Flotilla, which was a terrorist smuggling operation that kind of originated in Turkey and was bringing arms into Hamas and Gaza to use against Israel. And a lot of the funding for this, here we go, right? The circle starts tightening. A lot of the funding for this was through Code Pink, one of Soros's group, and still one of Soros's groups. So can you see how all these threads are tying together with Barry Baby in the middle? Yes. Let's talk about Valerie Jarrett. You know, I mention her often. Born in Iran, engineered the Iran deal, which would have allowed Iran to get a nuclear bomb and missiles to deliver to Israel or the United States. You know, paid them $150 billion. I mean, you know the Iran deal, which Trump is now undone. Valerie Jarrett was officially in charge of the Offices of Public Engagement and Intergovernmental Affairs. Let me tell you what her Twitter handle was. VJ44. Valerie Jarrett, 44th President. And you know, folks, I think in its own way that may convey to you just how much power Valerie Jarrett exercised over America, the American government, and the so-called president, Barry Obama, during the 8 years they were unfortunately in office. And Valerie Jarrett is smart. I mean, she is really smart. She was born, Valerie June Bowman Jarrett, to be exact. Valerie June Bowman Jarrett was born in Shiraz, Iran, 1956. Her father, a Howard University graduate, was a physician and a geneticist in Iran. Her mother, Barbara, was really deep into Chicago politics, the Daily Machine, the whole nine yards. Her maternal grandfather, Robert Taylor, was on the board of the Chicago Housing Authority. And by the way, there's still buildings that bear his name in Chicago. Robert Taylor Homes, public housing projects, etc. Jarrett was never subject to any confirmation by the United States Senate or Congress. She was a political appointee of Barack Obama. Quite clever. Every single report that you read of Obama's White House, even Rahm Emanuel's, his former chief of staff, his comments when he left the White House, was that it was she who was the real center of gravity in that administration. Healthcare reform, negotiating with Iran, and on and on. She was the power and the brains and the manipulation, the manipulator behind all that stuff. And many people thought, and I quote, the senior advisor, that's Jarrett, not the president, calls the shots at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, unquote. One of Robert Taylor's, her grandfather, one of his business partners was a guy by the name of Rufus Cook. Rufus's ex-wife, Anne, is a cousin of Jarrett's. Cook is also the legal counsel, you'll love this, for Louis Farrakhan's Nation of Islam, based out of Chicago. It's amazing, huh? In 2007, I think we were all shocked when this video emerged showing the pastor of Obama's church at that time, Reverend Wright, the Trinity United Church of Christ. America's chickens are coming home to roost. You remember that whole deal? It just so happens, to set the historical record correct, that that was a borrowed line by old Jeremiah. Okay, that borrowed line was spoken by the Nation of Islam's spokesman, whose name was Malcolm X. And it was referring to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, if you want to be historically correct. But Jeremiah Wright didn't mind borrowing it, and Michelle and Barack Obama, who sat in his pews for 20 years, didn't mind hearing it. It just so happens that Reverend Wright and Louis Farrakhan are thicker than thieves, folks. Imagine that. Are you surprised? Really good friends. In fact, in 1984, Wright and Farrakhan traveled together to Libya to meet Muammar Gaddafi. How come nobody reports on this stuff? I mean, these dots are so close together and so circular that a child could connect them into a balloon and color it red. Another Jarrett cousin, by the way, is Antoinette Tony Cook Bush. She's the daughter of Rufus and Anne. And in 2013, Tony, a Chicago lawyer, gee, imagine that, she was hired as the head lobbyist for News Corp, the owner of Fox News. And you'll love this. This might explain why at the then News Corp CEO, Rupert Murdoch, was often spotted dining with Valerie Jarrett. Whew, boy, the tentacles do reach far, do they not? Also, Jarrett's family has direct ties to, you guessed it, Obama's mentor, Frank Marshall Davis. Her father-in-law, Vernon Jarrett, was a journalist who worked with Frank Marshall Davis's Citizens Committee to Aid Packing House Workers. In his younger years, Kenger, remember the guy who wrote The Communist, Kenger explains Vernon Jarrett, quote, have been elected to the Illinois Council of American Youth for Democracy, the CPUSA, the Communist Party of the United States, youth wing. And by the way, Robert Taylor, whom we've been talking about, was also on the board of the Chicago Liberties Union with, none other than Frank Marshall Davis. Jarrett, by the way, met Obama in 1991. Many people presume that Davis actually introduced her, or Farrakhan. And guess what she did then? She introduced him to Michelle, whom he eventually married, as you know. And the three of them all consider themselves one big happy family. How nice. How nice. You know, that brings us really to the end of this show, because I'm not going to go over my allotted time here, particularly on our summer schedule. I'm going to pick this up next week. We're going to talk about more of Obama's cronies and friends. Tony Rezko. Okay, you've heard about him. I'm going to explain it to you. We're going to be talking about Nadmi Aku. Yes, you bet. Islamist supreme, billionaire, friends with Rezko, puppeteer of Obama. We're going to be talking about Rashid Khalidi, an anti-Semitic professor and historian of Palestine, and his connections with and friendship to, or connections to, friendship with Obama. And Edward Said, same deal. And we're going to be talking about several other folks whose names you may have heard in passing, kind of out there in left field, no pun intended, and how influential they were and are in Barack Obama's circle. And all these people, folks, are all not only linked to Obama, and not only linked by Obama, but they are linked to one another. This is the nucleus. This is the beating heart of the communist Islamist corpus in America. That's really what I'm bringing to you this morning, and what I'll finish up next week in conjunction with Part 5, The Acts and Lack of Acts of Obama. These are some scary dudes. What's even scarier is that the press, with hardly any exceptions, even though this information really is pretty much in plain sight for them, I mean, a modicum of digging would uncover it, and particularly in retrospect, looking at Obama's record, his acts, his lack of acts, Benghazi, and arming ISIS, and the whole nine yards. What's really scary is that they haven't done anything, and they continue to do nothing. By the way, to close out the show, in addition to the bug-eyed babe from the Bronx, Omar and Talib, being praised several times in public, across social media, you name it, by ISIS this past week for their unbelievable anti-American rants. Guess who else offered his congratulations to them? Specifically, well, to the entire freshman Congress class, but very specifically to those three women. You guessed it, Barry Obama. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. We'll talk at you next week with lots, lots more stuff.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.